Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you are interested in more of our great content, consider subscribing. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is only available to new subscribers. Welcome to our new season of The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. I'm kicking things off with a topic that I've been fascinated by. This gender divide in American politics and why it is so pronounced among Gen Zers. Now, in the recent past, young voters have been reliable supporters of the Democratic candidate for president, whether those young people were men or women. Just 4 years ago, a majority of both young men and young women voted for Joe Biden. But in 2024, things looked really different. A majority of young women did support Kamala Harris, but a majority of young men cast their vote for Donald Trump. In fact, 56% of young men voted for Trump compared to only 41% of young women. None of this was a surprise to Daniel Cox, my guest today. He's been watching this gender divergence unfold for years now. And he says it's happening on so many levels, that gender informs Gen Z's views on a range of issues from social to cultural and, of course, political. So I wanted to talk to him about why. What's making this cohort so different from previous generations? And how sticky is this? How long may we see this divergence last? Daniel Cox is the director of the Survey Center on American Life and a senior fellow in polling and public opinion at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Uncoupled, which will focus on the growing gender gap in American society. He also writes the Substack, American Storylines, which is great. You should subscribe to that as well. All right, here's our conversation. Daniel Cox, so glad to have you with me.
It's great to be here.
What I really enjoy about your work, Daniel, is that it's your interest in the gender gap goes beyond politics and voting. It's also about the way young men and women have increasingly different ideas on social attitudes, which have really big consequences for society as a whole. So I want to start actually with you, which is, how did you get interested in this topic?
Right. So it goes back a ways in one way or another. When I was getting my PhD, I was interested in politics and public opinion. And during that dissertation writing phase, when everything is really uncertain and up in the air, I shifted from doing straight politics to being really interested in more sort of sociological phenomena. Mm-hmm. So understanding how the people around us and our relationships influenced all sorts of things, our attitudes on policy questions, views about religion, gender roles, all that stuff. And even during my dissertation defense, one of the people on my committee asked, I don't think quite tongue-in-cheek, why they should give me a degree in political science and not sociology, which it took me a moment to answer. But I think it goes to a larger point that my work tends to kind of straddle these two domains. And it's absolutely right that I think the political divide between young men and young women is incredibly important. We saw that in the 2024 election with a surprisingly large gender gap among that cohort, the 18 to 29-year-olds. And I think it's important not to forget that. But I think what gets lost in all the political commentary about that generation is it goes so much further, right? If you look at how young people relate to and engage in various institutions, views about marriage, views about the family and having kids, views about religion, that we're sort of seeing very different trajectories for young men and young women.
And that's what I really love about this, because you, as you said, you focus so much on this younger generation, what we're really calling Gen Z, right? Is that that's really your sweet spot, the cohort that you're spending the most time with?
Yeah, so the you know as pollsters, we divide everyone in these age buckets, and it's for as long as I've been doing polling, which is almost 20 years now, it's always been the same thing. So it's 18 to 29, 30 to like 49, 50 to 64, and 65 plus. Who knows why we use those age categories? They're a little arbitrary. But that age group, 18 to 29, covers most of the Gen Z generation and a couple of the youngest millennials at this point. But every year, obviously, that changes.
So what makes them so different? And I mean, again, in your work, and I encourage all of my listeners here to follow you on Substack. You're coming out with a book, which we'll be able to get all of this in one place. But you really highlight the generational differences between men and women. So what happened with the Gen Z generation?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that I think are worth mentioning. When you look at the gender divide, you know, the polling that I've looked at and that I think tells like the clearest story shows that around 2015, 2016, there begins to emerge this ideological separation. So young women become significantly more liberal over that time period. Young men ideologically stay about the same, and so they become comparatively less liberal. But over that same time period, they become much more Republican. So most of them are independent, but they lean much more towards the Republican Party than at any point in like the last 20 years. And so I think that's there's a couple of things that are going on if we look at that time period. One is the election of Trump, obviously, in 2016. Very divisive figure. Women and men had very different views of him, his behavior, and then what he went on to do as president. Obviously, culturally, the Me Too movement was incredibly important, particularly for young women, many of whom said that the movie was really formative to their understanding about gender roles, the way women are treated in American society. And then lastly, the overturn of Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision. Again, for a lot of women, it really changed how they felt, and for a lot of women, how secure they felt being a woman in the United States. And the really remarkable things, if you look at these three cultural and political events, they really hit young men very differently. And in a lot of the conversations I've had with young men, you ask them about Me Too and the impact that had or how much they paid attention to it, and you get like shrugged shoulders or like, you know, kind of like, I don't really know. We had one guy who said, I thought that was like a celebrity thing. And so it's really remarkable how these experiences are understood, experienced so differently between young men and young women. And so that, I think, has been a really sort of critical part of what we're seeing today. That's sort of one big bucket of things. There's something else that's happening demographically that's also really important. One of the things we're seeing is the growth of LGBTQ identity among young people, and particularly among young women. And so the gap in LGBT identity is increasing. So roughly one in three young women now identify as something other than straight or heterosexual. It's about half as many for young men. So that's one trend. We're seeing the rise in number of young people who are single, and their politics obviously skew very significantly from people who are married. And then a religious decline. One of the really remarkable things that's happened is that if you look back over the course of modern American history, but even going maybe a little bit further back, young men have consistently been less religious than young women. And that's flipped in the past couple of years. So now we're seeing in our polling and other polls that young women are actually less religious than men. And their attitudes toward organized religion are increasingly suspicious. And so like you have these kind of slower moving tectonic forces combined with these sort of acute political and cultural experiences. And I think those things are kind of creating this larger divide between young men and young women, both politically and culturally.
But one of the other things that really stood out to me, Daniel, was that there's a generational divide even among women. So between young women and their mothers on how they identify. Very few Gen X women compared to their daughters identify as feminists. This question you asked about, would you prefer a female boss or a male boss or no preference? 61% of 18 to 29 year old Democratic women say they'd prefer a woman boss, but the women who would be their parents' or grandparents' age, it was something like just 15% or 30% would prefer a female boss. So all of these issues that you talked about, Trump, Me Too, Dobbs, impacted women across the age spectrum. And yet it seems like something very different was going on with the youngest women than were going on even with their parents or their older siblings.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely a generational component to all of this. And what's really interesting is that despite the progress that we've made towards gender equality, with obviously a lot of work yet to be done, that young women feel more pessimistic than older women about where we are in terms of gender equality in a variety, in the domestic realm and in politics and the workplace. And there's this acute feeling of insecurity and vulnerability that you hear when you talk to a lot of young women who believe that their rights are being stripped away, many of them who are concerned about the direction of our politics. And I think that is informing a lot of their politics and their political decisions, is that this feeling that they're no longer safe, that there are threats being marshaled against them, whether it comes to their reproductive health rights. You know, many of them identify as LGBTQ. So, you know, concerned about safety in the classroom or in the workplace. So I think that's really been a remarkable shift from previous generations of women. And you actually see this in some of the data that Gallup collects when they look at concerns about being a victim of a crime. So Gallup looked at like 12 different measures. Are you worried about being a victim of a carjacking, someone breaking into your house, a victim of theft? And they have a measure of concern about being a victim of sexual assault. And post 2017, for women under 50, that increased dramatically. And so certainly some of this has to do with the Me Too movement and the conversations that spawned, and concern about safety issues more broadly. But I think also social media is a pretty integral part.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. It has to be a really big piece of all of this, right? Wasn't there a whole meme about, would you rather be stuck in a forest? What would be scarier to you? Or what was it, a bear or a man?
A strange man or a strange bear in the woods.
What percentage of women were like, oh, I'd much rather fight off a grizzly bear?
Yeah.
Right? I feel safer with a grizzly bear or whatever than a strange man that came up to me while I'm alone in the woods.
Right. And it was, you know, I think meant to be on the one hand kind of provocative, but it was really notable that this trend took off on TikTok, how many women weighed in and said, yeah, obviously the bear, right? Than a strange man. And they a lot of them, you know, it quickly moved into really sort of serious conversations, right? So this is the experience I had being, you know, mistreated, sexually abused by a man. A bear would never do that to me. A bear at the worst would, you know, attack me, maybe kill me. But it wouldn't, you know, do that and then go off to his friends and laugh at me or make fun of me or record me. I think it captured the sense of insecurity that a lot of young women feel. And I think it goes back to how vulnerable a lot of us do feel on social media. There are a number of studies that show that, you know, women on social media are much more likely than men to face all sorts of harassment. They, you know, are exposed to, you know, inappropriate sexual advances at a very young age. And so I think that we can't ignore the role that our online lives and social media in particular is playing in shaping how we're experiencing the world and what we think of it.
That's right. And that older women who experienced being unsafe or sexual assault or harassment didn't have these tools when they were at that age, either to talk about it or express it. And so their experience was not all online in the way that younger women are able to make this, you know, a part of their social sort of experience.
Yeah. And I think there's a way in which the conversation has shifted pretty dramatically in a really important and good way, right? It's not something that you need to hide or be ashamed or embarrassed about, that these experiences are so common. So many women have them, you know, some significant number of men too, that they deserve to be talked about in a public way so that we can address them. And I think that's really, really positive. On the flip side of that, though, is that one of the things that's happened when you think about your own personal safety and feelings of vulnerability is that for, you know, a good long time, I think it was concern about the kind of one bad apple or, you know, the guy that would do these things. And you just like had to avoid that kind of person. But now I think understanding has shifted that these are, a lot of them are structural problems, right? That it's not just one bad apple. There's, you know, this kind of behavior may be perpetrated by a lot of different men. And actually we have a new study coming out that shows that young single women today believe that a lot of men would engage in this kind of behavior. And so it's no longer, you know, trying to avoid
the one gross dude.
Right. Mm-hmm. You have to watch where you are, what you're doing, because anyone could be a potential threat. And I think that's, you know, even if that's true, and I think there's some research that suggests that as people behave very differently in particular situations, how many we can certainly debate about. But that's a very different way to approach dating and relationships and to go through life. Then if you're just like, okay, I just have to make sure I don't run afoul or run into these kind of bad dudes.
Well, let's talk about the men who are also, the younger men who are also online a lot and the messages that they're getting, right? If women are talking about bears versus men, what the men are hearing, and I feel like I have a skeleton key to this, being the mom of a teenage boy, you know, even if he's just going online to look at clips of basketball dunks, inevitably the algorithm will bring him to some places where the conversation is pretty terrible. Or even the guys who ostensibly, right, they're about good health. Hey, stay healthy. Don't do drugs. Here's what I do at the gym. Here's what I eat. I'm like, oh, this is great. Good messages. And then we go pretty deep into some misogynistic talk. So it feels like the men and women, they're all on social media, but they're getting very different messages from what they're watching.
Yeah. And I have, you know, I have two young boys. And so, you know, this is top of mind for me personally. But a lot of the research suggests that this happens remarkably quickly, that you're looking for benign topics on improving yourself, you know, working out, eating healthy. And then the algorithm starts feeding you this really toxic, misogynistic content. And some studies suggested that this happens within like 30 minutes of you being online. And so it's not, I think we have to do away with this old understanding of how people use the internet, right? That, oh, you know, there's these dark corners of the internet that are, right. You know, have this kind of content and only certain types of people ever go there. It's no, you could be almost on any platform, whether it's Reddit or Instagram or TikTok, and this stuff will find you. And it's pretty remarkable. I mean, the other thing too, this is something that we heard in our focus groups, that there's a lot of this content that young men say that they're not even looking for, and it just finds them. So
100%,
like provocative stuff, pornography or, you know, sexually explicit images or videos. And one of the guys said, you know, I'm just trying to watch LeBron do some dunks, and this stuff is coming, you know, at me, and I don't know how to control it or turn it off. And it's a huge problem.
A quick break. We'll be back. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the next few weeks, we'll be rolling out race ratings for governors, the House, and the Senate. It's never too early to think about next year's midterms, and we'll have everything you need to know about these races. But it's only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. I'm going to shift us now actually to the politics of all of this. You know, there's been a lot of conversation since the election about the Trump campaign and their effectiveness in going onto social media, going onto podcasts, being in the YouTuber universe, especially with a lot of these very male-oriented podcasters, Joe Rogan being the best example of that. Was Trump's success then just meeting men where they were, or and conversely, Democrats not meeting men where they were? Or is it that these men were always more likely to support Donald Trump, but they just needed to be asked? Are these more conservative men, or are they men who hadn't really thought about politics until, say, you know, Donald Trump became part of the conversation?
I think one of Donald Trump's assets in terms of his, you know, how people perceived him politically is that, you know, they didn't view him as an ideologue, right? He wasn't pushing this hardcore conservative agenda. He wasn't pursuing a woke or very progressive agenda. And for a lot of voters, particularly those in the middle, those are, you know, swingable, they don't want someone very ideologically oriented. They want someone who's pragmatic, who's thoughtful, who will represent their interests. And one of the really interesting things I looked at right before I joined you all is looking at the ideological breakdown among young men and young women in terms of how they voted. And Trump did really well among young male moderates. So he did 14 points better among that group than he did among the women who identified that way. So it's not just that all young men are becoming conservative and they're opposed to legal abortion. No, they, I think, have very moderate views in a lot of cases. And I think Donald Trump benefited from that. I think a lot of people who support same-sex marriage and legal access to abortion ended up voting for him because they didn't see in him someone who's really has strong ideological views. And so I think particularly among young men who aren't that motivated on a lot of these issues, I think that's one of the things that really separates them. If you look at issues like gun control or climate change, abortion, reproductive health, women's rights, all these issues, women care about them far more than men. And there are very few issues that young men care more than young women. I mean, maybe inflation or the economy overall. But this, again, emerges in all these conversations where they say, yeah, I just kind of like Trump. He's strong. He sticks to his guns. And that's kind of it, right?
That was the appeal.
Right.
Yeah. Well, talk about the strong piece, because obviously the campaign really did make an effort, both in its advertising, but really in almost every one of its public appearance, Trump's public appearances, of being tough, strong. I remember sitting at the convention where his final night had, right, Kid Rock, Hulk Hogan, and the head of the UFC fighting group, right? This was not subtle.
Yeah.
When we're talking about macho and masculine. So is it an appeal that, I guess that's the question, is how much of the appeal is it about what it means to be a man, and how much of the appeal is he just wasn't an ideologue?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a combination. I think that that reputation for being strong and unapologetic about his views and, you know, I don't care a lick about being politically incorrect, I think that plays really well to young men, right, who are often either or scolded or, you know, meant to feel bad or criticized for what they say. You know, this idea that, you know, quote unquote, silence is violence. A number of the young men I talked to said that, you know, if they don't say the right thing, if they don't appear to be supportive of various groups, then they get criticized. And I think in Trump, they saw someone who was like, wow, this guy is not doing any of the things that I feel constrained or hemmed in by. And that's really refreshing. And so I think like that's where we see some of the gender divergences there. I think something else is that this feeling of anxiety and security about the future, I think is widely shared among the public. I think we're at a place where, you know, we've seen remarkable cultural change, social change. The world seems to be a pretty scary place. And in Trump, we'll hear someone who's strong and will be willing to protect me and my community and the country. And that, quite frankly, is enough.
The other thing that I talked to post-election, I talked to a number of Democratic strategists, especially those who work with young men of color. So first, I want to talk about some of the racial dynamics too. We have a gender divide, we have racial, but what so many of those strategists told me was that part of the appeal that Trump had to these younger men of color was that he was not the status quo, and that Democrats have become the avatar of institutionalism And for so many of these young men, they feel like these institutions, it's not just that they haven't been, they don't feel like they've been helped. They feel like they've actually been failed by these institutions. And so, whereas we just talked about, you know, women feeling like the undercutting of Roe, the laws that are getting rolled back are actually the undercutting of those institutions are problematic for them. For men, so many of them saw an appeal in Trump was that he wasn't going to be held back by institutions.
Right. Yeah. So if you're worried that the political system is set up to advantage wealthy people or liberal people or whoever, people that aren't you, someone who promises to tear down the system or is not going to abide by the rules or can articulate and identify the people who are taking advantage of you, that's an incredibly potent message. And I think one that Trump from the very beginning has used, you know, very effectively to appeal to folks who largely mistrust our economic system, our political system. And these are the people that Trump does really well with, people with low levels of social and institutional trust. That is, if anyone, his base.
And yet the conversation going into the election, Daniel, was that, yeah, he has an appeal to them, but they don't always show up and vote, right? Because if you are not invested in the system, why should you even turn out and vote? And that the theory, certainly from the Harris campaign, was that young women were more motivated to vote because specifically of the Roe decision. So what happened? Why did that not turn out the way that Harris had expected it to go?
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to Trump, you know, we've seen from the past two previous elections and now in 2024 again, that he can bring out these irregular voters. Yeah, not all of them, but a number of them will come out to vote for him because they do see him as a change agent, someone who will, you know, buck the system and upend things. And if you think things are careening off in a negative direction and you say, oh, this one guy is going to stop it or at least stop things from getting any worse, that's a pretty powerful motivator. And I think that's what happened for a lot of these folks. And one of the questions that I have is like, how replicable is this moving forward?
That's what I was going to ask.
It's very unlikely, I would say at this point, that Trump would be on the ballot again, you know, barring something pretty extreme, you know, never say never. But, you know, how does J.D. Vance or whoever follows Trump marshal that same energy and that feelings of aggrievement to become politically engaged? And I just simply don't know if that's possible.
Well, and Republicans are now the status quo. They're the ones in charge at this moment in time. So in 2028, you know, it will be a referendum on the people who were actually doing the governing. But another way to ask this question too, Daniel, is if you are giving advice to Democrats, who there's no doubt they're very cognizant of this gap, how do they reconnect? You know, you're hearing stories about, we need our own Joe Rogan. We need to, versus, I would argue the real issue is they have to find a way to genuinely and authentically communicate rather than trying to build a channel. You've got to have somebody who people want to listen to.
Yeah, I think honestly, you could take some lessons from Trump. Trump doesn't worry about offending people. He thinks what he's doing is right, and he says, ah, this is what I'm going to do. And I think the Democratic Party is this coalition of all these different demographic or identity groups, and they want to make sure everyone's represented and no one is upset about anything. And I think it's really difficult to build a compelling brand that way because you're trying to be everything to everyone, and then you end up meaning nothing. And I think the Democratic brand has suffered remarkably over the last, you know, 8 or 10 years. It wasn't that long ago, looking at, you know, Pew data, that the Democratic Party was viewed much more popular positively than the Republican Party. So they had this really, important asset in brand identity, and that has been basically washed away. And now people don't like either party. And for the party moving forward, I think simply showing up and sort of saying, hey, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. And it's not about identity groups, right? It's not about we're going to do this for this group and this the group. You know, these are the policy. These are our principles. These are the values that orient us. And from that, you can build, I think, a more enduring coalition.
Talk, though, about, I raised it earlier, but I didn't follow up on just the differences among younger men by race. I mean, we've known for a long time now that, you know, younger white men have been more conservative, leaning, vote more Republican. And as I said, there's certainly significant movement among Latino and younger Black men to Trump. What can you tell us about why you're seeing that movement? Again, go back to 2008. The theory of the case was that Democrats were the party of identities. They were the party that welcomed everybody, and that Republicans were the party that was pretty monochromatic when it came to race. How did that change?
I think Trump really appealed to those further down the educational and economic spectrum. And that is a group that we saw him make gains in from his first, you know, foray in 2016 to 2024, him building this non-college coalition. And it's really critical to remember that for a lot of these voters, particularly for, you know, Black men or Hispanic men, their economic outcomes are not at all as good as their female peers. So Black women have much better educational outcomes than Black men, at least those under 30. The same is true with among Hispanics. And so there's a way in which that, you know, Trump's economic message that, you know, hey, you being left behind is going to be more acutely felt by those who are suffering more and are unable to achieve the economic success that they want. And so I think that's been a big part of his success there.
Looking more broadly at this gap between men and women, younger men and women, they're obviously every year getting older, like the rest of us. Does this gap continue to widen? And if so, what does this do to American society?
Yeah, that's, I think, a critical question. And, you know, it's impossible to look at the data now and say this will go on forever, but it also seems very likely that it will end in the next couple of years. I think because of how ingrained some of these attitudes are, again, when it comes to marriage and views of single life, you know, single women today are much more likely to say that you're more happy, like single women are happier than married women. And a lot of this, again, comes back to the social media diets. There's so much negativity around marriage and relationships and commitment. We even asked on a recent survey, to what extent are you coming across content of women critical of men, you know, complaining about dates or complaining about their husband or boyfriend? And most women see this content fairly regularly. And I think it can't not have a pretty significant impact on how you view these institutions, right? I think that, you know, my place of worship or church, the place I was raised, doesn't treat men and women the same. I think, you know, if I get married, my husband will be able to coast along on the overwhelming amount of domestic labor that I'm going to be responsible for, particularly if I have kids. And there's a way in which the data suggests that there is still a real discrepancy in the amount of domestic labor that men and women do when it comes to the pro-social engagement of going to meetings, you know, being a member of the PTA.
Right. Doing all the school activities, doing all of the, right.
Yeah.
Pick up, drop off, et cetera.
It's, yeah. And all the organizing, right? All the text chains, all the email chains. It's largely, not all, but largely women who are spearheading a lot of these efforts. And that's a real problem, right? And I think the answer is not for women to pull back, right? There's a new article that was recently published about man-keeping, that the work that women do to make sure that men are socially engaged and civically active is a big problem and a part of why we see gender inequality in other spaces. But I think the answer there is not to say, oh, women, you should pull back and not do more, but rather help men catch up and engage socially and civically in a way that they previously haven't. And we see this. Men who are married and have young kids do a lot more than those who are single. In a past report, we called married parents, both men and women, civic superheroes. They are doing a lot. So it's not about or it's not completely about the culture or masculinity even. I think it's just about motivation. And I think having a kid living in a community where you feel connected to encourages people to get out and evolve and help others. And I think that's really where we need to focus.
Right. And this idea of social isolation, which, right, you're together, but you're apart. Again, I see this with my own kid who spends a great deal of time talking to people from around the world. It's pretty remarkable, the mm-hmm. people that he communicates with through video gaming that he would never meet in real life, who literally are living in other parts of the country or the world that he's never going to go to. And it's a great education, but he's not meeting them in human life. And you can still be comfortable in your own space, right? You don't have to share it with anybody else. You don't have to share your bathroom. You don't have to you don't have to get dressed, all of that. I think maybe we've forgotten how to be social. Is that part of what's going on here for this younger group? Like, they didn't have to, and they can still be connected.
This may not be a completely fair characterization, but I do think some of those social outlets, whether it's online gaming or social media, is kind of like junk food. You're getting some amount of mm-hmm. calories, mm-hmm. right? You are doing something, but it's not really what your body needs. It's not what your spirit needs. Yeah. And we need that in-person interaction, this regular structured engagements to forge connections and create a sense of mutual obligation that I am responsible for you. I am a good friend. I am a good son or daughter. And this is what I owe you as that person or a classmate or what have you. And I think that is really missing from a lot of the online activities, right? It's easy to wait and say, okay, this is what this person had for lunch. Great. I know what's going on in their life.
Right.
And I really worry about this when it comes to artificial intelligence and the rise of AI boyfriends and girlfriends and chatbots. I think, again, it can easily replace some of these other kinds of social connections that are much more positive and longer lasting. It's not healthy or helpful to have someone agreeing that you're awesome all the time, because sometimes, quite frankly, you're not awesome.
You're not awesome, or that there are consequences for your actions, and that it does. It stinks to get in a fight with a good friend, but that is life, mm-hmm. and you have to learn how to negotiate that. I talk to folks who work in, you know, higher education, and they talk about the real challenge they're having with people getting upset with roommates and not knowing how to solve mm-hmm. that, and that they are expecting either one to be accommodated, or two, that the adult will kind of fix it for them because that's right. all they know.
No, being able to navigate conflict is critical, and it's a skill that we learn. We're not endowed right. knowing how to manage different people of different backgrounds and experiences. And I think this goes right back to where we started with the gender divide, that it's incredibly important to do that in relationships, whether they're platonic, whether they're romantic, that you're not always going to see eye to eye with your partner or the person you're dating, but it's really important to be curious, to be empathetic, and to try to understand where they're coming from. And I think anything that takes us away from that or downplays it or disincentivizes us from learning that is part of the problem.
All right, Daniel, I'm going to let you leave with giving us something maybe optimistic or hopeful in some of your research, that because you can go down this rabbit hole and think, oh my gosh, this generation, forget just about the gender divide piece of it. This is a pretty depressing world that they may be inheriting. Where can we find some hope?
I think fundamentally, one of the things that I remain most optimistic about, and I've never been accused of being an optimist, is that I think there's still a real hunger for social connection and belonging. We know this generation is far less likely to be raised in religious communities, spends less time in their own communities connecting and volunteering. But I think there is still, you know, an appetite to do this kind of stuff, to forge these kind of connections. And I think part of it has to start with parents and helping socialize their kids into like understanding it's not just about you. It's not just about your personal accolades or achievements. It's about what we do for others, about our communities. I remember when I first started out in public polling and was focused on social capital, the concept of third place, right? These places that we go that are not our home, not our workplace, but they're coffee shops or bars, bookstores, you know, gyms. That was not in the common conversation. We weren't talking about it in a way that I hear it, and I hear young people talking about it as well. So it seems to me that there is a way that we can build something on this, and young people are I think ready to do that, and I think they just need some encouragement and support to get there.
Well, Daniel, this has been a fascinating conversation. Much more to come. Good luck finishing up your work on your book. Can't wait to see it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You are our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, O-D-D, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.